Hello and welcome to Let's Pod This. My name is Andy Moore. Friends, it's good to be with you again this week. Welcome back to the Democracy Den. If you're watching this on YouTube or on social media, I guess, you might notice we have a new setup. I've been trying a few new things with new cameras and stuff to make the whole office just really one big podcast studio. And my intern thinks I'm probably kooky, which is fine, because she gets to run the board when she's here. So if you do follow along on video, you can anticipate we'll probably try out a few things to see if this works. This isn't a high budget, like television studio. It's just an office in a basement. So, thanks for being here. Nonetheless, today we're going to be talking about the initiative petition process and about Senate Bill 1027, which passed back in the spring and that is currently in litigation, trying to prevent it from going into effect and trying to highlight the ways that it's unconstitutional, at least in some of our opinions. And joining me today for this conversation is my good friend and colleague, Amber England. Hi, Amber. Thanks for being here.
Hi, Andy. Thank you for having me. Nice setup you have in here, by the way.
Thanks. It's welcome to the Democracy
Day. I'm super impressed by all the tech that you have. It's pretty incredible.
You know, if you're a nerd and you just collect stuff in a closet for years, it turns out you can put it to use at some point.
All right. Well, I'm excited. Am I the first guest in the new studio setup?
You are, actually.
Okay. That's cool.
How fun is that?
Yeah.
Let's start with talking about the initiative petition process.
Okay.
You are someone who's been involved with many campaigns.
Yeah.
I've been involved with like one and a half. Don't have near the experience you do. But can you give us like an overview of it? And then, I mean, I'll chime in along the way, but if someone just asks you, tell me about the Oklahoma initiative petition process.
Yeah, I would say that in our Oklahoma Constitution, Oklahomans have the right to go directly to the ballot to change issues for themselves. That's like the simplest way to really explain it to someone. The longer version is we have a very, very complicated, difficult process that if you can surmount all of the hurdles put in front of you, collect enough signatures in a very, very short amount of time, survive legal challenges, survive signature challenges, get your gist written just perfectly so that the Supreme Court, you know, allows it to go forward should you get challenged, and you clear all those hurdles and the Secretary of State declares that you have enough signatures and no one actually, you know, has any sort of, you know, opinion about the way the ballot title is written, then maybe you can actually put an issue on the ballot. It's a difficult process. It should not be easy. It shouldn't be an easy process. You know, it should be difficult. Because if it wasn't difficult, we may be frivolously using this right. And I just don't think that's what our founders intended. I think what they did intend, though, was for the people to be able to decide issues for themselves, particularly when politicians refuse to take up important issues. Either they don't have the political courage to do so, or they've tried many, many times and just for whatever reason can't make it happen in the legislature. This was our founders saying, hey, the people of Oklahoma have the right to do this. And in doing so, putting it in our Constitution, making Oklahoma the first state in the nation to do so, I think it just speaks to our roots as populists and wanting Oklahomans to have the ability to self-govern and go around powerful politicians so that Oklahomans are seen as an equal, an equal power with those politicians.
I think that's such a good point. I mean, when I talk about this, I say a very similar spiel. And as I've thought about it more and more, there's like two parts that really stand out to me. One is that Oklahoma was the first state to put the initiative petition in their state constitution. Now, some of that is interesting because we were the 46th state to be admitted to the union.
Right.
We're pretty late to the game, even as a state. And now there's, you know, roughly half of the states have an initiative petition process in some form or another. But having it in the constitution gives us voters, the people, like an extra shot in the arm of, I think, power or control or self-governance.
Yeah, I mean, I think the way that the article reads is the first power reserved for the people is the initiative. I mean, they were very clear.
Yeah.
about that power for voters. And I mean, I wish I could go back in time and thank them individually, but I do. I think it's a really cool thing about Oklahoma, and really does speak to our independent streak, if you will. Like, Oklahomans like to have decision-making authority and autonomy, and our founders recognized that and put it in the Constitution. And how amazing that we have this right still today. I would say 1027 severely restricts that right, and quite frankly, it puts it there on paper, but in practical sense, we don't have the right anymore, specifically if this bill is to stand. That's the initiative petition process in a nutshell.
Well, yeah, I think you're exactly right. And we'll get into the nuts and bolts of that legislation in just a second. But the other thing that stands out to me, and you said it, I think, more clearly than I've ever heard it, is that viewing the public as a co-equal in this. So often we talk about the branches of government, the executive, the legislative, and the judicial, and they get all the press. And they just have a, you know, cursory statement of like, well, it's up to voters to decide. But when you reframe our political system as three branches of government, and that the voters really are I'll say co-equal governing body,
right?
We have more power than just elections themselves. We have this opportunity, this pathway. And what I always say is that the founders knew on some level that there would be times in the history of our state where our politicians are unable or unwilling to pass laws that people want. And that might be because they get blocked by another branch in some way. As an example, I mean, Medicaid expansion, which you worked on, you ran, right? The legislature passed some version of Medicaid expansion. The governor vetoed it. And after like a 10-year fight, and then it ended up, the people said, hey, we actually want this. We're going to do it our way. And so the voters are the ones that led the charge to pass it.
I don't think the legislature actually ever passed expansion. But I do know that Governor Henry tried, I think, to put it in by executive order.
Oh, really?
Yeah. I think it started as early as Governor Henry's like first or right. His last term.
When the ACA was like,
yeah. I'll have to go back and look to see. But I don't think the legislature actually ever passed it. Governor Fallon actually tried to also do it via executive order as well. So, the legislature just didn't want to, quote, you know, put Obamacare anywhere near Oklahoma. Right. And as it turns out, nearly 400,000 people have gotten health care because of that decision. Rural hospitals have been able to be saved. And, oh, by the way, the state is recouping billions of taxpayer dollars that for a decade were going to other states like California and New York. So the people wisely knew that while this could have been, you know, a hard decision for politicians to make, it wasn't a difficult decision for voters to make. They right. knew what the right thing was to do, yeah. And they did it.
Well, and that's exactly right. And in that story, right? So if you've got some governors trying to pass it, others not, the legislature's always talking about it for a long time, you got agency heads proposing. And at the end of the day, politicians couldn't get it done.
Right.
It came to the people.
That's right.
That is a great example of why there's some wisdom in crowds, right? Of trusting the people to do the right thing for their state. Ballot initiatives are difficult. They are expensive. It takes a ton of just like manpower and coordination and, will to get it.
Yeah.
Well,
and there are two different paths to the ballot, right? So there's a legislative referendum and then there's initiative petition. And so oftentimes when you go to vote on a state question, people don't realize that was put on by the legislature. So oftentimes when they don't even want to make the decision themselves, they're like, oh, well, let's just send it to the ballot and let the people vote on that. So they did that on Right to Farm. It failed at the ballot box. Some other things, Right to Work was put on the ballot by the legislature. And so that we have two different kinds of state questions, if you will. I mean, and we have a veto referendum that's rarely used, but in House Bill 1017 back in the 90s, that was upheld by the people. It was passed by the legislature. A group of folks didn't want 1017 to become law. And so it was put on the ballot and it was upheld by the people. So there are many different ways that you can use the quote initial petition or state question process. But I think it is important to remind folks that there's kind of three different ways that you would utilize this or the way state questions appear on your ballot.
Right. Yeah, and the legislatively referred measures, I wish that they were designated as such on the ballot, and just so voters knew that, like, this wasn't a citizen-led effort, this was from the legislature.
Yeah.
Sometimes it's because they have to, right? If the legislature is trying to amend the state constitution, they cannot do that on their own.
Correct.
It has to go through the vote of the people. But they also just refer statutory things. Sometimes, I guess they usually just refer constitutional changes. I can't think of any statutory change.
I don't know, like, was Marcy's Law, it was put on the ballot by the legislature. I don't know if it was a constitutional change or not. Sometimes they just put it on the ballot when they maybe don't want to actually have to vote up or down on an issue. I'm trying to think what else was put on the ballot
that's what I think of is them putting stuff on the ballot, because it takes a simple majority.
The Ten Commandments on the state grounds, I believe. Oh, right. There were some other things. Like in 2016, I think there were something like 7 or 8 state questions on the ballot, and only 2 of them, 780 and 781, I believe, and then 779 were all put on by initiative petition. So the people actually did that. Everything else that was on the ballot that year, right to farm, I think Marcy's Law was on the ballot that year too. Those were all legislatively referred.
There was an ophthalmology one around
that time. That actually was put on the ballot through the people. It was an initiative petition process.
But it failed. It failed at the ballot, and then the legislature came back the next year and passed a statutory change on their own.
I think so. And then also the liquor law changes. I think they put those on the ballot through the legislature, and then we voted on them.
Right.
So, you know, there's been different things throughout the course of our state, and we are talking about the ones, I think, closer to history as of today. But I think another misnomer, and this has been pushed by the legislature, because I think they want people to believe that Oklahomans are just running afoul to this right, that we're using it too often, it's just being overused, out of state people are coming in trying to, you know, influence our elections. There have been so few state questions that are initiative petitions, those brought by the people, to make it all the way from, hey, I'm going to go file this, to it actually becoming law. Oftentimes people will file something. I was involved in, we filed an initiative petition and we pulled it. That happened twice with the gerrymandering initiative petition. Another one related to taxing gross production taxes, as we were trying to push the legislature to raise taxes for education funding. We filed an initiative petition shortly before the step up vote and shortly before the teacher walkout. And lo and behold, that got folks' attention. And then we were able to pull it after the legislature did what we wanted them to do. And so that was sort of a tactic in order to push the legislature. Oftentimes it will get to signatures and folks won't be able to get enough signatures, so then it doesn't move forward. So you can go on the Secretary of State's website and you can see every state question in the history of Oklahoma, and if it was legislatively referred, what the vote was, and then what happened. Like, is the process, did it stall out? Was it withdrawn by the opponents or by the proponents? So the Secretary of State's website, you know, if you're a nerd like me, you can get on there and look to see all the different state questions of the history of our state.
Well, I'm an extra big nerd, so I have a spreadsheet with all this information that I pull from the Secretary of State's website. And so by the numbers, in case our listeners are interested, and there's a couple that have been proposed more recently that I haven't updated this, so I'm a month or three behind. But in total, there's been about 835 things that are proposed. Now, of those, 436 were initiatives proposed by the people, 345 were legislatively referred measures, and then 54 were veto referendums, which is also of the people, but trying to veto a law that the legislature passed. Now, so the raw numbers, okay, that's fine. Of those, only about half appeared on the ballot. Now, 94% of the legislatively referred measures appeared on the ballot. It's a shoe-in, right?
Right.
Only 20% of the citizen-proposed measures.
20%. 20%.
Right. Now, some of those were ones that were, like, filed and pulled back.
Sure.
But not 80% of them.
Correct.
And then when you look at how many actually passed, it's even smaller, right? So about half, 55% of the legislatively referred measures passed. So almost all of them made on the ballot, only about half passed. But of initiative petitions, only 6%.
So of the 20% that actually make it to the ballot, only 6% of those?
No.
Okay.
28% of those. So only 6% of the total. There's been 436 proposed by the people. Only 6% of those, only 25 out of 436 have actually
become law. So 25 laws in the history of our state have made it into law because of the initiative petition process. How many laws are passed just in one legislative session? Yeah. Hundreds, right?
Yeah, usually between 300 or 400, I think. So.
Correct. Yeah, so my point is that this process is difficult. It should be difficult. Maybe it should be a tiny bit simpler, mm-hmm. But it is not being overused by the people.
Right.
Therefore, any attempt to make it harder by the legislature to try to, as this 1027 law does, to me, is not about, well, our process needs fixing, it's been used too much. It's about power. Mm-hmm. Who has it? Who doesn't have it? Who they want to have it? Who they don't want to have it? And so, you know, if you can just cut the noise and be like, well, what are all these changes about? What is this about? It's about power.
Right.
And they don't like to hear that, but it is the truth.
It's true. So many things are not actually partisan issues. They're power issues.
Correct.
We come back to that more and more. And I think right now is an interesting time in our country for lots of reasons, but certainly to talk about like populism and the will of the people and how we make that happen. And so when you've got tools like the initiative petition and you have hundreds of thousands or millions of voters who have a vision for what they believe the future of their state should look like, we want to make sure that those people understand that these tools are available to them, what the parameters are for how to use it, what the attacks are trying to make it harder, and how we can fight back to ensure that we get to keep these rights, because it really is a big deal. I have colleagues like you do in states that don't have the initiative petition. In many of those states, they're fighting for it, trying to get it passed. But it's real hard to pass something when you literally don't have the pathway to do so.
Correct. Yeah.
You have to curry favor and help legislators understand that it's a good idea. But again, they are hesitant to give up their power in other states. And here where they already have to, because the Constitution says so, we see this pushback, right? A clamping down, restricting from the legislature on the process. And that's what Senate Bill 1027 was really all about.
Yeah. And I would say, like, the other part of this conversation that I think is important is that when you see a state question make it to the ballot by the people and it fails, it doesn't mean that the issue that you were trying to push is not a winning issue or an important issue. And oftentimes it actually pushes the legislature to do the right thing. So it's as intended, not just for the Oklahoma folks to govern themselves through initiative petition, but to push the legislature to actually fix something. So I think about my first state question was state question 779. That's the first one I was ever paid to work on, I would say. I was the campaign manager. I ran an education organization who was the backbone of that state question. We worked with then President David Boren to try to have a conversation around education funding that failed miserably at the ballot box, I would say. We got barely 40% on election night. But, you know, 2 years later, the legislature actually passed what at the time was the biggest tax package for education funding in the history of our state. without that failed state question, that would have never happened because of another state question, 640, that said in order to raise taxes in Oklahoma, you have to have either a 3/4 majority vote in the legislature or a vote of the people. And so just to get to that threshold, you know, we had to really make our case that people wanted they wanted education funding to be fixed, or at least, you know, they wanted a teacher pay raise. And so I think about that. I think about the terribly failed state question. Shout out to my friends who ran that campaign. It failed miserably. It was a gasoline tax. It was like in the early 2000s, and it was just as the gas prices were just going up crazy high, and they were going to do a gas tax to help pay for road and bridge funding. And because it couldn't get the legislature to do it. And this was when Democrats had control.
Right. Because it requires a 3/4 majority in both chambers to raise revenue.
Yes. Yeah. And so, but what they did do once this state question passed, I mean, failed. And I think it only got like less than 20% support at the ballot box. The legislature actually came in the very next legislative session and put a package together that created a constitutionally protected fund, or I think it was a protected fund. Maybe it wasn't constitutionally protected, but a lockbox, if you will, if we're going back to our Al Gore days, that provided off-the-top funding for road and bridge projects across the state of Oklahoma, which had never happened. It was a lot of money. I'm sure that like road contractors were thrilled about this package that passed through the legislature. But again, I don't think the legislature would have done that had the state question not actually been able to, you know, have a robust conversation, paid media to push the legislature to do something. And so in those two cases, the state question failed, but the legislature was pushed to do it themselves, and they finally did it.
Right, right. That's interesting. Some of this stuff, I know that most of our listeners are not sitting around reading the history of Oklahoma politics, but you should. It's fascinating.
There's yeah.
Hilarious stories. And it, as I have, got into this over the last decade, the more that I learn about the state, the more that I understand, like, how we got here now, which is where I started, was like, how did we get in this situation? And going back and learning all the ebbs and flows and the power back and forth and the decisions that were made by voters or by politicians, you really start to understand, I think, the ethos of Oklahoma in a different way, which is in part why I can understand, well, I disagree, but I can understand why politicians feel threatened by the initiative petition process and why they're, you know, trying to pass restrictions like through Senate Bill 1027. So let's maybe talk about that.
Yeah.
You want to get into it?
Sure. I would just also add really quickly that the legislature should be careful with the changes that they make to the initiative petition power process, because the pendulum of power will swing eventually in the state of Oklahoma. And right now, Republicans have all the power. Every statewide office, supermajority in the legislature. And they want to make the state question process harder, okay? But they used the state question process to actually get themselves into power. In the 90s, they passed term limits. And when term limits went into effect, the first year term limits went into effect, the Democrats lost control of the House for the first time in the history of the state. And then 2 years later, when the rest of the Senate seats were on the ballot, we tied. It was a tie for 2 years, but they would have got it that year. But a Republican actually switched parties to a Democrat. And so the Democrats sort of and Republicans shared power for 2 years. But the term limit state question that was pushed by the Republicans did exactly what they needed it to do, which was shift the balance of power to Republicans in the state. And so they need to be careful with the changes that they make to the initiative petition process, because someday they don't need to use their initiative petition process now. They have full control. If they want a law, they can pass it. But one day they won't have this power, because the power will swing back to Democrats or independents or a coalition government. You know, like, it's just not permanent. And I know that maybe they don't believe that or think that right now because there is such a supermajority. But
that's what Democrats said when they were in
power. Correct. It is also like, you know, it is just the history of our country. Power shifts back and forth all the time. And it may be a long time before Democrats are back in power in Oklahoma. But Eventually, power will shift, and the folks who are trying to attack the initiative petition process now will need it to push Democrats who are in control, or push independents who are in control, or push the coalition of government that's in control. I really hope if legislators are listening, that they would really think about the changes that they're making. And if the shoe were on the other foot and they needed to use the state question process, do they really want to dismantle it? Right. It's a dangerous road to go down.
Well, because it's really a tool of accountability, right? For voters to like, it's not really a threat, but it's, if I'm a legislator and I know that the people have the ability to like pass something on their own, that does, or it should affect my calculus on how I conduct myself with my votes in office and be mindful that like, you can't just run the table on voters as long as it's out there. Right. And I'm not saying that that's what they're trying to do, but sometimes it is.
Yeah. I think that they should view the state question process as both helpful to them and also as a way to say, well, gosh, if we don't get this done, the people might. Mm-hmm. And so if they're complaining about people using the initiative process too much, all they really have to do is actually address these issues themselves. They could have done that with Medicaid expansion. They could have done that with minimum wage that's going to be on the ballot in June of 2026. They could have done it with criminal justice reform. All of these issues that are appearing on the ballot or have appeared on the ballot over the last decade, there's no shortage of laws that have been filed or bills that have been filed on these issues. Some have even actually made it out of committee, didn't get a floor vote. Some of them didn't get a committee vote. But if they don't want people using the state question process, just pass the damn bills themselves. Right. You know?
Or get out of the way. Like, I've talked to some legislators who are thankful that we have the initiative petition process because it means that they can push back on an issue, but then the people can still pass it on their own and they don't have to take the vote. So they're not on the record.
Correct. They could view it that way, right. Very much so, but many of them do not.
Yeah. Well, let's talk about Senate Bill 1027 that passed in the spring. And for listeners who have been with us for a while, I'm certain that we talked about it back then. So this will be a bit of a refresher.
Yeah.
It made a bunch of changes to it. It changes the ones that I'll go off the top of my head and then I'll kick it to you. But I know it changes where signatures are collected in like kind of a backwards way. So the big thing I think has caught the news is it creates essentially a cap on the number of signatures per county, mm-hmm. which cumulatively means a cap on the number of signatures statewide. Right now, there's no cap. You can collect as many signatures as your heart and time will allow within the 90 days.
Right.
This makes a big change there. Some other restrictions or changes to who can collect, issues about funding, a bunch of other stuff.
Yeah, also a big change is allowing the Secretary of State to write the gist of the petition. And while that sounds like super, like, who cares, it's really, really important because right now the proponent, so if you want to do a state question, you write the gist. And then if other folks think it's not written correctly, they can file a legal challenge and the court settles it.
Right.
So there's not a politician, there's not an elected politician that's actually, like, making that decision because the court just says, hey, this is legally sufficient or not legally sufficient. If it's not legally sufficient, the proponents have to go back, rewrite the gist, and do it again. Right. So it's always on the people to write the gist. Right. This shifts that to an unelected, politically appointed Secretary of State. You can see in other states where this is the case. They use it as a stall tactic. Yeah. So it just keeps getting rewritten and rewritten. It's so nefarious, you never know, is this going to be the right way to write it or not? And the Secretary of State just keeps resubmitting it. So I would say that that's probably one of the most dangerous pieces in the legislation. And you said that it changes where signatures are collected. And that's not technically true. I think what it means is it's actually limiting the number of people in Oklahoma that can sign it regardless of geography. So the way the legislature is framing that is like, well, we want to make sure rural people have a say. Right now, rural people have as much say as folks in Oklahoma County, as much say as folks in Tulsa County. So it's even. Everyone has the exact same chance of being able to sign the petition. This actually puts a cap on the number of people regardless of where you live. Right. So if you are living in Lone Grove, where I was born and raised in southern Oklahoma, if you aren't part of the, 11%, I think it is, for constitutional measures, if you're the number 12%, if you're that, let's just say there's 100 people in that county that could sign it. I don't have the numbers off the top of my head, but like for simplicity, let's say a specific county, the 11% is 100 people. If you're 101, sorry, you don't get to sign it.
Right. Yeah, there's a, I forget the counties. One county, the cap is 78 people.
Probably like Harmon County or something like that.
And like Cimarron County, yeah. Something like that. Mm-hmm. Yeah, less than 100 people. And so, I mean, any good campaign is going to try to go to all 77 counties because it's the right thing to do. And you do want to give as many people as you can the chance to sign the petition.
Well, you're trying to build a grassroots campaign, yeah, because you have to win with 51% of, or 50% plus one, right, of all voters in the state. So, Tulsa and Oklahoma County, if you put all the voters in Tulsa and Oklahoma County and you just had them vote, they are less than, I think, like less than 40%, right, of the total electorate in the state. Right. And so you can't just stay in two counties and win an election. You can't stay just in two counties and get enough signatures. And so that's the myth, right, that these state questions only go to Tulsa and Oklahoma City. And I remember very distinctly, both on Medicaid expansion and then last summer on minimum wage, we went all around. I was in Claremore, Owosso, Ardmore, McAllister, and these were leaving petitions with people there, Ada. So we had volunteers who were citizens of Carter County going to events in Carter County, collecting signatures from their neighbors. And so this wasn't just like the campaign going up, showing up one day and getting signatures. We were actually activating volunteers in these communities, and they were getting signatures from their neighbors. And so I'm offended, quite frankly, on the notion that folks in rural Oklahoma don't get opportunities to sign this. It's also, to me, it's like saying that people who live in other parts of the state don't come into Oklahoma City and Tulsa ever to do business. Like, people don't go to OU football games or basketball games, or people don't go to a Thunder game, or that only people in Oklahoma City go to a Thunder game, or only people who live in Tulsa would go to the Tulsa State Fair. It's just not true. And I just think it's silly. And it's interesting because I actually think they believe that narrative. And it's unfortunate. I really wish they would just embed themselves on a campaign. And then maybe they could see how difficult the process is and how much we rely on volunteers throughout the state of Oklahoma. And how some of these restrictions have actually made it harder. Because now, when I first started working on state questions, you could put a copy of the initial petition on the website, and folks could download it. So if you were living in Cimarron County and you wanted to sign the petition, you could get on the internet, you could download the petition, you could make a copy of it, collect signatures, and mail it back to the campaign or mail it back to the Secretary of State's office. Now, the campaign has to print all of the petition packets because they have to be a specific weight. They have to have the specific print on that so that the scanner can actually scan the actual things. So we've already made it more difficult for folks to get engaged in a campaign by just the changes that were made prior to 1027. Because now for folks to be able to carry around a petition in other parts of the state, the campaign has to go to them, or we have to figure out a way to get these printed petitions out to these folks. And they only give us 90 days to do that. They didn't change that at all. And so I would say that, like, all the changes that have made prior to this 1027 and then with 1027 combined, all of them are just really making it as if we don't have an initial petition process in Oklahoma.
Yeah. I was looking at the open primaries campaign they had announced. They'll be starting signature collection at the end of this month. October 29th.
Yep.
And so they need 173,000 and some odd signatures as a bare minimum, right? They obviously have to collect many more than that because they have to pad that, because some of them will be invalid or thrown out for various reasons. And even so, let's say we round up to 180,000. Now, to be clear, they're going to have to collect, like, you know, 230 or 240 or something. But at 180,000 signatures in 90 days, that is 2,000 signatures
per day.
Per day. Every day. Sundays, Mondays, every day for 90 days. And in reality, you have to get more than that in a little bit less time because you need some time to, like, count. But you think about, like, right now going into the fall and winter in Oklahoma, weather varies a great deal. We could have an ice storm and shut everything down for all we know. And that means you really have to get out there and hustle. And it just, I think, drives the point home of how difficult the process
already is. Yeah. On minimum wage, last year, we were collecting from April through mid-April through mid-July. And then on Medicaid expansion in 2019, we were carrying signatures starting in July, or end of July, so all of August, September, and October. There were days that it was 100 degrees outside.
I got sunburns in both those campaigns.
And and that's, you know, volunteers doing a two-hour shift.
Right.
It's kind of dangerous, you know, like, and if you have to get, I mean, on Medicaid expansion, we turned in over 300,000 signatures. And then on minimum wage, we needed to collect, I think it was like 92,000, and we collected just under 180,000, so nearly double, because we weren't certain which rules we were going to be under, because they actually changed the rules in the middle of our signature collection process. And so we collected as if we were under this new process that now 836, which is open primaries, which is like they changed the data points. It's all very like technical, but essentially it just means that like sometimes these people's signatures aren't going to count that should count because of the different data points.
Yeah.
So it's hard. If you've ever been inside a signature collection process, it is wild. And just the process you have to put in place, like, you know, we had like volunteer signature notary spots in I think 7 different counties for minimum wage. And then we had a very clear protocol around how the signatures are to be counted. Then we do an internal validation process, and then we turn them into the Secretary of State's office. And it's a very sophisticated, very difficult process that people shouldn't try to make even more difficult just because they want more power.
Yeah.
If it's broken, fix it. And you and I can talk about the ways that we should fix the initiation process to make it more efficient, to make it more fair, to make it, I don't want to say easier, because I actually firmly believe that this process should not be easy. It should be robust.
Yeah.
But these changes with 1027 and the ones prior were not to do anything but to make it harder,
right?
Intentionally.
Right. Yes, I'm opposed to changes for the sake of making it harder, just to make it harder. It doesn't make it any more secure or anything that's
correct.
Alleged. Well, let's talk about the challenges of 1027 and where that's at right now.
Okay.
And then I'd love to end with a little bit of brainstorming about how the process could be better.
Okay. Yeah.
So there were legal challenges, right? Filed shortly after session ended, like early summer, challenging the constitutionality of this bill when it passed. Long-time listeners know the legislature doesn't always pass constitutional laws.
Right.
Sadly, this happens way too often. And so the challenges some of them were filed by, I think, the Open Primaries campaign, because they had already initiated their campaign, and they were like, hang on, you can't change things.
Yeah, they filed a lawsuit on the retroactivity piece, saying that it shouldn't apply to them because they were already in the process as these changes were being made to the initiative process, and that would be not fair.
Right.
And so the court actually ordered a temporary stay for 836. And so right now, they are under the old rules.
Right.
Yeah.
That was like a little line in their, in the ruling that was about the challenges to that campaign itself. They said, oh, also by the, like, you guys can go ahead. And by the way, you play under the old rules. But they didn't say when they would be addressing the challenges to 1027 itself, aside from that. But now, I guess since then, they've set the date for when they're going to hear oral arguments.
Correct. And so the oral argument for the overall constitutionality piece lawsuit, so there were two separate lawsuits filed, 836 specifically saying they retroactively should not apply to them. That has been settled. They have a temporary order. It should not apply to them. This 1027 lawsuit, the overall constitutionality, is going to be heard November 18th. That's the one that has like all the different players. And so there's been a lot of different organizations and a lot of different politicians weighing in with what they call amicus briefs. And maybe you call them amicus briefs. I kind of use that word interchangeably because I did not go to law school. But essentially a friend of the court brief, if you will. And so on the side of the people, I would say, that have filed those friend of the court briefs are people like the League of Women Voters, the Oklahoma Academy, former federal judge Robert Henry, and his attorney who wrote that was historian and attorney Bob Burke. And so, you know, this is clearly the people lining up, I mean, to protect their right to the ballot. And on the other side, those who are fighting to keep 1027 in place and it not be ruled unconstitutional, as I'm sure you are just shocked to know that 68 sitting lawmakers, politicians, yes, filed a friend of the court brief to say, no, this should be upheld. In addition, there's two former attorneys general and a former Republican governor, politicians themselves, that have filed a friend of the court briefs with aligning. So it's essentially, I think it's great. It's like on one side, you have the politicians and on one side, you have the people. Very, very clear who where the lines are drawn there.
We really need someone to like dress up like Mean Gene Okerman out in the middle with like a wrestling ring out in front of the building. Yeah.
Yeah.
That's great. So oral arguments will be November 18th?
Correct. 10 a.m.
At 10 a.m. Is it at the state capitol?
Yeah, it's at the state capitol in the old chambers. Okay. So the historic chambers.
Second floor.
Second floor. Side. Yeah. I've attended a lot of these now, and I never don't get like goosebumps when I watch the folks walk out, the justices. It is a very it's pageantry. I mean, you know, it's very like traditional. They come out in their black robes, they come out from a curtain, and they sit down, and you know, both sides argue, and it's not like they argue against, it's not like a court drama where they're, you know, objection, Your Honor. It's none of that. It's very, you know, one side gives their opening, the next side gives their opening, and then there's a rebuttal time, and then it's over. Yeah. And then you wait to hear what the court decides.
Yeah. And in my experience, as someone who has been in that courtroom, as a, I guess I was a defendant in that case with the gerrymandering stuff, and all the other ones that I've attended, I almost never leave feeling confident in which side, like, won. Like, the justices ask really hard questions, and their intent is to kind of throw off both sides, off balance a little bit, and make them really, like, justify why they're even here. I mean, I like the to be clear, the justices are not, like, indignant about it, but I like when it's, there's, like, an impetus to be like, no, really, we're all here. Why is that? Like, is this a legitimate argument on both sides? And I think, to me, as a, you know, just a citizen, as a bystander, I think the weight with which the court conducts their job is affirming to me. I'm like, good, this should be important. If we're going to talk about amending the state constitution, or if we're going to talk about changing the way that the initiative petition process works, you better come ready to, like, with your A game, right? To like really talk about this.
And I think that the justices, over the history of time, when it comes to the initiative petition, there's a very clear, narrative that emerges from the court, regardless of which governor appointed the judge, whether it was a Republican appointee or a Democratic appointee. The judges are very, very protective of the initial petition process. They try to protect that in a way of like, they understand the initial petition's power. They understand the constitutional right of Oklahoma voters. And they have typically, sided with the rights of the people to continue, unless it's an egregious constitutional challenge or something like that. They have sided with the people of Oklahoma because they, I think, take their jobs very seriously. They understand that that this right of this constitutional right of people is one that was put in our Constitution. And so it will be interesting to see how the judges rule here. To me, it is clearly unconstitutional for a variety of different reasons. But, you never know. I think I always also love reading the opinions of the justices. So I'm both looking forward to the court hearing and then also reading the opinion of the court once it comes down.
Yeah, for sure. I do think it helps that it's so clear in the Constitution, right? You said it earlier, like it says the first right and it's in black and white. Now, obviously, there's some room for interpretation, but not as much with this as there are with some other issues. And I think that I am thankful that that's kind of how it's written in there.
Yeah.
So with this the hearing, it's open to the public. People can go.
Yeah. The courtroom's relatively small, but there's room, and folks should come. I've done a couple of different interviews now, and I think it is important. It kind of sucks that it's in the middle of the workday. Yeah. And so unless you're close by or maybe you're retired, maybe you want your mom to take you out of class because it's a good civics lesson. I don't really care how you get there, but I think it's important for people to see their government in action. There needs to be like legislative days on the weekends and at night so that people can participate in their government. I've often said that I want to democratize legislative session by like dressing in jeans and a t-shirt because it's like such a stuffy process. People are like, you have to wear a suit and tie. They make it that way intentionally. Like they say it's like, to just the decorum of the House and the decorum of the Senate, but it's also kind of a way to make it exclusive. And so I would think it'd be like really, really cool if the legislature would conduct, and they do some like, night work when it's a deadline week or whatever, but in general, they should really try to do legislative session more at night and on the weekends so that like regular people, people who are doing shift work, like anyone can find a time to come to the state capitol to see their lawmakers in action. It's at 10 o'clock on a weekday. So if you just happen to be able to make it, we would love to show you this process up close and personal.
Yeah. And we'll be sure to share it on our social channels and on email and stuff. And I can your story about the democratizing democracy, I guess. But when in the early days of Let's Fix This, in probably 2016 or 2017, there was a night where they were up there doing work late at night, passing laws that under the cover of darkness, and the press corps was starving because they didn't, you kept thinking it was going to be over any minute and just kept going and going and going. Mm-hmm. And so some of us, like, I think ordered pizza or maybe it was like insomnia cookies and took it up there for the press corps. And I had on like jeans and a t-shirt, and which made me feel a little out of place.
Yeah.
I think I had on shorts and I was like, can I walk in here in shorts? And then we went and sat in the gallery, and there was probably 15 of us, but you could see the legislators' faces change of being like, I didn't think anyone was going to be watching us. There weren't even any lobbyists up there.
Yeah.
It was real funny, and I was like, this is how it should be.
Yeah.
They should know that people are watching all the time.
We don't have a very transparent legislative process, and I was involved in a campaign a few years ago to try to do some reforms around making our government, our legislative process more transparent. Both sides hated it. I just want to say it wasn't just Republicans that were fighting us. It was Democrats as well. I think they like the exclusivity. Mm-hmm. It's unfortunate. There needs to be a real revolution around our legislative process and making it more open and accessible to normal folks, because trust that normal folks are paying the price for the legislature's laws that are passed when people aren't looking. Yeah. From anything to what they pay in taxes, what they pay, at the grocery store, what their insurance rates are, whether or not they can, have more time to pay their rent, if they're getting ready to be evicted, to if their schools are properly funded, if they have a hospital in their backyard. Like, these are very important issues that folks should be able to weigh in on. And right now, it's a very exclusive club. It's lobbyists and lawmakers. When you go to the state capitol during session, that's who it is. Mm-hmm. I mean, unless there's like a day at the capitol for this specific advocacy group. But it's a very exclusive club. You probably can name all the lobbyists in the building, and so can I, and you can name all the legislators. I think they like it that way. And I think going back to the state question process, this is really a way to inject common sense, the common man, into the bill writing process. And they don't like that, because this exclusive club, we have all the power, and state questions are really like, nope, Jim Bob down the street gets to have a say in what this law looks like. Yeah. And I think that's why I'm so passionate about it, because my dad is a factory worker. He worked in a factory his whole life. He worked shift work. There is no way in hell he could have made it to the Capitol to weigh in on an issue that would have impacted his life. And so really the state question process is a way that he has power. And I think about my dad and all the other people who need more access and ability to shape laws. And if they can't get to the Capitol, then the state question process is a way for them to have a say in their government.
Yeah, nothing pops the ego of a politician like a well-run initiative petition campaign.
Yeah.
Well, Amber, as we wrap up, there's a lot of other shows that like end with a question. Ezra Klein does this. He always asks his guests for 3 books, which I promptly add to my Amazon wish list and then never order them. I probably got 100 books on there. So maybe I'll start doing this too. But since we're talking about this, if you could change, I think my question would be, if you could change one thing about Oklahoma, what would it be? But specific for you, if you could change the initiative petition process and you were going to rewrite it brand new from what it is today, how would you design it?
Yeah. I've thought about this a lot. I actually have written several proposals on try to get funding to actually do this. I think that the signature collection process needs to be longer. So 90 days is, if they want more participation from rural Oklahoma, if they want more participation from Oklahoma voters, the best way to do that is to increase the number of days. I don't have like a timeline, go to 6 months, go to a year, but give people more time to actually collect those signatures. I think that's the number one change I would make. But I also would put some timelines around the opposition. So like right now, all the timelines negatively impact the proponents. We have 90 days to collect the signatures. There's a 90-day protest period on the front end and the back end. There's no time certain that signatures have to be counted. There's no time certain that the court has to rule on whether a challenge to a gist is constitutional or not. And in the actual coverage of the 836 challenge, so there was a group of Republicans that challenged 836, which is the open primaries. Rhonda Villamont Smith, who is a former Tulsa County GOP chair, was quoted in the newspaper as saying, well, we didn't win this legal challenge, so it's really not our point. We wanted to delay the process. And so I think like putting some time certain on how long the people have to count, how long the Secretary of State has to count, how long the courts have to make the decision. And then also, you shouldn't be able to delay a vote for as long as like minimum wage. So we qualified in August of 2024.
Mm-hmm. In enough time, theoretically, to be on the ballot in 2024.
We easily could have been on a ballot in 2024. Maybe not November, right? There has to be 70 days between the day you qualify and the day, like, because of, like, printing ballots. But there's a December election date. There was a February election date in 2025. There was a March election date in 2025. There was an April election date in 2025. There's an election right now today. But we aren't on the ballot until June of 2026. We filed that initial petition in October of 2023. So it will be nearly 3 years before folks would have the ability to decide this. So, you know, I don't know if the answer is every state question should be on a November ballot, but there should be a time certain from the time you qualify to the time you get on a ballot, because it's just really rigging the system in favor of politicians and taking away power from voters. So those are the three big things I would change about the process. Again, I wouldn't change things to make it easier. I would change things to make it more transparent. I would change things to make it more fair to voters and to people. And I would change it to make it more efficient.
Yeah, I love all of those things. I will add one from my own box, and that is right now we have two different summary paragraphs with slightly different rules. The gist, which appears on the signature form, mm-hmm. and then the ballot title, it appears on the ballot. And I have yet to understand why we have two different ones. Can we just have one paragraph that we use in both places? Because right now all it serves is two different points of conflict, right? You argue about one, then you argue about the other one.
Mm-hmm.
They're basically the same. Let's just have one and call it good. Even when you explain the process to voters,
you go like, what's a gist? What's a gist?
Why do we have this?
And what's the ballot title?
Right.
The ballot title is what's on the ballot.
Right.
The gist is what's on the signature page. It's hard.
And everyone understands, well, it's got to be on the ballot. Why is there something else? It's like, that's a really good question.
Yeah.
You should just, because you're going to be reading one on the day you vote anyway. Isn't that good enough?
Yeah.
I will say, earlier this year, we did a series of virtual town halls about this, and I keep meaning to schedule some more, but this year's gotten away from me. When we did those, the number one thing that all the regular folks said that attended those was the signature collection timeline, the same thing. And we would have discussion about how long is long enough? And the answers, I guess it's like the same three answers. People would say probably 6 months, or they would say, well, what do other states do? Can we align with them? And the answer is usually about 6 months, what most states do. And then you always have a small group of folks that are like, no timeline, just let us collect them until we get it.
Yeah.
Okay, that's what some states do. But it was, I've yet to meet someone who is an actual voter who thinks
that 90 days is
right.
It's just so hard.
So you can't do anything in 90 days.
Yeah.
I can barely schedule lunch with my friends in 90 days.
Yeah, it's hard.
Well, Amber, and thanks so much for being here today and talking about this. Is there anything else that we haven't touched on that you want to bring up?
No, I think we've covered it all.
All right. Well, I'm sure. You and I can probably sit for 6 hours and discuss the nuances of the initiative petition process. We won't subject our listeners to that this
yeah.
week. But Amber England, thanks so much for being here today.
Thank you for having me.
Listeners, thank you for being here as well, as always. I will put in the show notes this episode that date, and we'll make sure that you get reminded about it as we get closer to that court date. I'm hoping to be there. Will it be dressed as a piece of legislation? Who knows? We'll find out how silly I feel that day. But I do think this is a really important issue, and if you're not already paying attention to it, you should be. Initiative petitions are a huge way that you have a direct say in what's happening in our state. I'm thankful for them. I hope you are too. I hope you take advantage of it. There are a couple of campaigns collecting signatures right now. We mentioned open primaries will be starting theirs at the end of the month as well. If you'd like to volunteer, there's lots of opportunities to get involved with campaigns and get a bit more of an inside look onto how democracy happens in our state. As we say every week, decisions are made by those who show up. I hope you'll find a chance this week.